From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, controversy continues over the high number of reserve cops in the village of Oakley.
As a reservist, you can bring your firearm anywhere. That, I think, is one of the catches of being a volunteer cop.
Shining some light on how local leaders view ethics among other politicians.
Only 5% of local leaders think that state legislators in Michigan are very ethical. That's certainly a concern.
A film festival in Detroit begins its four-day run tomorrow. We'll get a preview of this year's lineup.
Not only is there a lot of films being made here, but there are a lot of films that are being made by Michigan filmmakers who are coming home and telling stories and using our landscape as their background.
And from beer to books, the latest in a string of trademark disputes popping up around the state. Oakley, Michigan, small town, fewer than 300 people, with a force of 110 reserve police officers. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the Oakley voluntary cop controversy. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Lansing right now. And joining me is Zoe Clark. She's the political junkie at Michigan Radio. And Rick Pluta, he's the bureau chief for Michigan Public Radio Network. And, of course, they're the dynamic duo who make up It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio. So let's start with something that's been called for by the Democrats. They say, hey, look, shouldn't the executive branch and the rest of state government be a little more transparent? Why can't we file a Freedom of Information Act against those folks and get some information about how the inner workings of the executive branch goes?
Right, Lester. Michigan is one of only two states in the country that completely allows state lawmakers, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and their offices to be exempt from FOIA.
You can FOIA a state department.
But these other offices. Offices, nor the governor or the lieutenant governor. And for the past couple sessions, Democrats have introduced legislation saying, hey, this shouldn't be exempt anymore. Folks should be able, through FOIA, to be able to get emails and documents.
Well, given the governor's statement in his very first State of the State address that he's going to have a transparent government, he's going to sign this if it gets through.
Well, let's see if this
gets
to
his desk.
That's a that's a highly theoretical construction that you've proposed here, Lester. Although we should point out that a prominent member of his administration, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, has proposed some FOIA reforms, really focused on the legislative branch when he was serving as a state lawmaker.
Yeah.
And of course, even if the administration was okay with this, the Democrats just boosted it up a notch and brought in financial disclosure, which is like whoa, wait a minute. Getting lawmakers to disclose their personal assets as a condition of holding office has been kind of a non-starter around here for a very long time.
Which is something, though, that nationally, federal offices have to do.
Many states, because we there's a potential conflict of interest.
Have you ever noticed how no one runs for Congress anymore?
Yeah, I think we get a daily announcement about that. No, seriously, though, this is something that happens in many other states because there's this great concern that there's going to be a conflict of interest. If you're running a trucking firm and you pass all this legislation that's going to benefit truckers.
Yeah.
Maybe the people might want to know that.
Well, and we've seen that happen, right? And also what opponents to this legislation say is they'll say constituent services, that they don't want to be under FOIA, let's say, if, the big bad media went and wanted some information about some emails, let's say, with a constituent. What opponents will say is, hey, that's private, right? I'm their representative.
Well, it's always been a concern. Mm-hmm. And actually, whenever, this has been proposed, that there's been some sort of carve out for constituents communicating with their legislator about some kind of private problem.
Sure.
I mean, certainly if a constituent communicated with a legislator about, say, a tax issue, that you would probably want that to be confidential, the same way as if they'd communicated with the Department of Treasury. So that's always an element of it, but that is part of the internal tension on this topic, which is exactly how far do you go in mandating freedom of information. And when you're talking about what's going on in the governor's office, they say that one of the reasons that you want to exempt a governor is so that the governor can freely seek out advice without worrying that it's going to, that advice is going to be made public, before a decision is made.
Now, I'm more worried about a constituent contacting a legislator about a little help on pushing that contract through.
Well, sure. And, you know, certainly that happens. But I think that'd be more likely to be an in-person conversation than, you know, someone sending an email. And quite frankly, legislators are typically very sensitive to exactly that. I remember this was many, many years ago, but a lawmaker, I mean, he was chuckling, showed me a campaign contribution that he was going to return because it was from a doctor. And in the notation line on the check, it said for medical malpractice vote.
All right, let's move on and talk about we have a new state treasurer.
We do, we will. We soon will, yeah.
Right. He's waiting until after the filing deadline to take the job.
Smart man. I don't know
what that says.
Well, there's been much made about the fact that this new guy that the governor has tapped was a lobbyist for DTE. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. He's a registered lobbyist.
He's registered as a lobbyist.
Right. So what does that mean? Who is this guy, and why would the governor want him for treasurer?
Well, his name is Nick Curry, and he does tax policy and government affairs for DTE, which is a one of the state's major utilities. And a lot of times people in positions like that register as lobbyists, even though it's really not a regular part of their job. DTE's probably retained a multi-client in Lansing to do its day-to-day lobbying.
You mean multi-client lobbyist firm, right?
Yeah, a multi-client lobbying firm, right. To do their day-to-day lobbying in Lansing. And but someone like a Nick Curry would be registered so that if he comes in to testify, if he's hanging out in the lobby of the House or the Senate to talk to lawmakers as they're debating a particular issue, that they're not going to get burned on that. In fact, Nick Curry has a pretty lengthy state government resume.
And this is something, Rick, you and I were talking about just earlier mm-hmm. today, this idea that he once used to work for mm-hmm. former Governor John Engler.
He worked for Governor Engler. He mm-hmm. was a deputy state treasurer. He even worked for Engler and the Senate Fiscal Agency when Engler was the Senate Majority Leader. Yeah. And he is part of what it's informal, but there is sort of a Republican government in waiting. And that when a Democrat is in the governor's office, there are Republicans who have served in state government, and maybe during a Democratic administration they will bump down into the civil service, mm-hmm. waiting to move up
pulling
again
their heels
when another. Sometimes they have responsible substantial projects. Often, but waiting for someone of their party to move into the top job again. Right now there is certainly a Democratic government in waiting, where people are maybe serving in another branch of government. Maybe they're in the civil service. Maybe they're working for a not-for-profit or for a union or something like that. And the next time that there is a Democratic governor, those people will come back and serve in administration positions.
All right, let's talk about Tim Skubick, or not Skubick specifically, but his show Off the Record. His guest this past weekend was Ronna Romney McDaniel, mm-hmm. the newly elected GOP chairwoman.
Yeah.
And Zoe Clark, you were there. The bright lights were on you.
I was one of the panelists on the program, yeah.
So what was the news there?
Well, I think some of the news came out of the fact that earlier last week, Dave Ajema, the Republican National Committee man representing Michigan, made some more comments, controversial comments this time about President Obama race and ethnicity.
Well, he sought to break down Obama's racial makeup
what was it,
down
like
to
62
partial
points,
percentage points.
62.7%.
And so Chairwoman McDaniel, we asked her, and I would say pressed her, on whether or not she believed Dave Ajema needed to resign, something that her predecessor, Bobby Shostak, has called for, that national Republicans all over the country, that Governor Snyder has called for. And she still, unlike her fellow Republicans, would not call on him to step down, saying that all conversations that she and Mr. Ajema have had are private and that they will stay private, and that she is not ready to say as much.
I got to ask you, because, I follow a lot of Republicans on mm-hmm. Facebook, and there's been a lot of controversy among some Republicans who just say, why are we still dealing with this? Why are we dealing with this guy?
Yeah.
And enough is enough.
And the answer to that question, Lester, is he still has a base in the Michigan Republican Party.
I know he does.
I was at the party's winter convention, And there were signs were ubiquitous, signs and buttons that said, "I stand with Dave Ajima." And
so what does that say about the Michigan Republican Party in general?
Well, what Republicans will say is that they don't have the rules, that there is nowhere in their rule book to make him step down. Democrats, including the chair of the Democratic Party, Lon Johnson, wrote this open letter after Off the Record was done taping on Friday to McDaniel saying, look, you could if you wanted to. You could push him out. Here are some ways to do it. And others have said the same thing.
Well, I think there are two things. One is, you know, you sort of have to ask the question. Now, a political party is a private organization, although it has a very public face. And do you want to be in the position of ejecting people who've been elected by a party convention, by delegates, over something that they've said? You could see why a lot of Republicans would want Dave Ajima to be gone, but you would also be opening a can of worms if that became the standard by which you removed people. What is the standard for not standing by the party platform? Well, that means then that any Republican who comes out in favor of same-sex marriage could be removed by a vote of the executive board or something like that. But at the same time,
is the Republican Party now saying we stand behind bigoted and racist speech?
They're trying to, at least some people are trying to have it both ways, and we will see what happens if and when Mr. Ajima is up for re-election as the national committeeman.
Yeah.
That is Rick Pluta. He's the bureau chief for Michigan Public Radio Network, and Zoe Clark, our resident political junkie. They, of course, are the folks who bring you It's Just Politics every week here on Michigan Radio. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lester. Hey,
pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Think back to the people who lived in your neighborhood when you were younger. If you grew up in Detroit in the 1940s, the 50s, and 60s around the Brewster Douglas projects, there were plenty of characters. How about the numbers lady who helped run illegal betting games but always had a stick of gum for the kids? There was the hot tamale man and Huckabuck and Shorty Black and a prostitute named Peaches and a cop named Rotation Slim.
What?
When?
Why?
I am curious.
It's our Am I Curious project, where you ask a question and we figure out the answer. Today, Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris finds out what it was like growing up in the Brewster Douglas projects in Detroit. And the answer involves tight-knit neighborhoods and a lot of singing.
Ruby Strotter says if she had to do it all over again, she'd move into the Brewster projects in a heartbeat.
It was just like family there. People were different. The whole attitudes in the projects were like solid. Everybody. Looked out for each other.
Strotter lived in the Brewsters from 1957 to 1972. She says back then, if it was raining outside and you left your car windows down, somebody would reach in and roll them up. And Strotter says nobody ever went hungry. If there was a family that couldn't pay their rent, neighbors would start up a card game.
It's called a rent party, and they would give it to whomever that needed to have their rent paid. It was no making fun of who had whatever on then. Nobody was poor. Everybody was the same.
She says parents had strict control over their kids. But other adults were also active when it came to supervising other people's kids. Warner Doyle McBride grew up next door to the projects in the Brush Park area. He remembers this one time when he went down the street and he might have stolen some apples from a neighbor's yard. Can't quite remember.
And I'd get home and my mother said, Miss Johnson called and said you were down the street doing such and such. And I said, no, Mom, that wasn't me. She tore my butt up. And you know why? Because she said, do you think Mother Johnson would call here and tell me a lie about what you were doing down the street?
He says kids knew when the streetlights came on, you had to be home.
You were confined to certain areas. And when you're confined, you had to find things to do. And the nicest thing to do was to sit and sing and harmonize.
People sang on street corners and in the parks and on porches all the time. And people also sang inside the projects.
It got to the point where you could be on a stairwell and you could hear a fabulous harmony coming from some of the people singing in the stairwells because that was the best place for an echo.
That's Mary Wilson from The Supremes. And she grew up in the Brewster Douglas projects. So did the other two members of The Supremes, Diana Ross and Florence Ballard. Wilson says back then, people would sing and dance on the streets because they were hearing this new thing called rock and roll on the TV and radio. She says she met so many different kinds of people in the projects that it actually helped prepare her for the experiences she had as an international star traveling around the world. In fact, she's got a little story she likes to tell. It happened at a special performance in London. All the royal family was there, and after the show, they were doing a meet and greet with the royals. Wilson says there they were, standing in line, three young women from the Detroit Projects in their gorgeous pink gowns.
And so, you know, Princess Anne comes by, Prince Charles, da-da-da-da, and everybody comes by. And then we met the Queen Mother, who was just charming.
And then Princess Margaret came by.
And she stopped right in front of me, and she said, "Ooh! Is that a wig you're wearing?"
Now remember, the Supremes were known for their long eyelashes and beehive hairdos.
So when she said this very loud. Everyone kind of turned. And when she said this, it was like, oh my God, I was so embarrassed, you know. And then I looked at her like I could kill her. But the thought that went through my mind was, she reminded me of one of the neighbors who lived on the same floor that we lived on in the Brewster Projects on the second floor, who was this really loud, gregarious, just uncouth woman. And you could always say, Miss, I forgot her name, Miss So-and-so, oh my God, here she comes again with her loud mouth. And that's what ran through my head.
Mary Wilson of the Supremes realized that whether you live in the projects or a palace, people are people, and no one is better than you. So feel good about who you are. Wilson says that's what the Brewster Douglas Projects taught her. For Stateside, I'm Kyle Norris, Michigan Radio News.
Tomorrow we'll talk with comedian Lonnie Love. She grew up in the Brewster Projects in the 1970s and 80s. That's when things got a little rougher. Love says her childhood in the projects was fascinating and bittersweet, and it also made her into the person she is today. The Freak Film Festival begins a four-day run tomorrow, and joining us to talk about the event is Artistic Director Kathy Kilishevsky. So this is the second year for the Freak Film Fest. You're starting it out with a double feature. Tell me a little bit about your Fire and Water films, starting with The Fire.
Sure. That is, there are two free press videographers, photographers who are producing the movies for that night. And the Fire documentary called Fire Photo 1 is about a gentleman named Bill Eisner. But now Bill Eisner has been essentially the unofficial photographer for the Detroit Fire Department for, you know, going on, you know, over 50 years now. And essentially he has the largest, most comprehensive archive of Detroit on fire in photography and in Super 8 and on audio, and as well as the firefighters battling those fires. And this documentary takes a look at Bill and his archive and the kind of guy he is, but also a broader look at how fire has shaped the city of Detroit.
I was going to say, as one of the cities that fights fire more than most, and I understand that he's been accepted by the firefighters as one of their own just simply because he's there.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, he has spent so much time behind the front lines with them that they call him brother.
Let's talk about Graveyard of the Great Lakes. What you said that's another free photographer?
Yes, Eric Seals is the photographer who directed and produced that film, which, by the way, Brian Kaufman was the one who had done the film prior to that. He was the director on Packard the Last Shift, which was our opening night last year.
Mm-hmm.
But Graveyard of the Great Lakes is a look at a guy named David Trotter, and he is probably the most prolific shipwreck hunter on the Great Lakes. There's estimated to be about 6,000 shipwrecks on the bottom of the Great Lakes, and Lake Huron has quite a few of them, and he has found about 100. And so we take a look at Dave and kind of his quest and his passion, but also what he uncovers when he, you know, dives below the surfaces of Lake Huron and uncovers these shipwrecks and the stories behind them.
Last year, a lot of the films were documentaries, and you've got several this year, too, but you've also included some fiction, such as It Follows. Tell me about that film and why you chose it.
Well, that film was done by a Clawson native, and part of the reason, well, at least part of the philosophy behind including a narrative in a documentary film festival is Michigan has, you know, been wrapped up in the film community and with the film incentives and things like that for a long time now. And so there's not only is there a lot of films being made here, but there are a lot of films that are being made by Michigan filmmakers who are coming home and telling stories and using our landscape as their background. And so the filmmaker David Roper Mitchell came here. Most of it is shot in Michigan. A lot of it is very familiar. But the story is a kind of a psychological horror thriller about a girl who is being essentially followed by this thing.
Entity.
This demon.
Yeah.
Yeah, this entity that, you know, it can only be gotten and given away by having sex with another human being. And so there's kind of a moral dilemma that goes on there for her and as to what, you know, what she should do with it and who she should essentially curse with this. And so it's a really compelling tale. He's been getting a lot of hype. This premiered at Sundance. It's coming here. He will be here for the two screenings that we're having, which are Friday night at Cinema Detroit, which is one of our partner venues. And so it's going to be a really cool opportunity to talk to him and to see this, you know, very much talked about film.
Now, throughout the film festival, you look at everything from the auto industry. There are several films about that. The Black Panthers, churches, the jitterbug. Sounds like a little bit of something for everyone. What did you learn from last year that influenced your choices for the second annual event?
That's a good question. You know, I think the thing that confirmed kind of what we were thinking last year, because it's not just a screening of a film. It's a screening of a film plus. We always have an additional program associated with the film. If it's not a Q&A with the director, we are, you know, with the Let's Have Some Church Detroit Style, which is the movie about a Detroit gospel choir. The gospel choir is actually coming to perform after the film.
Mm-hmm.
With the movie The Jit about the jitterbugs and that Detroit style dance that was kind of created here by the jitterbugs. We're going to have the jitterbugs do a demonstration of the jit, and then it's going to go into a dance party emceed by hip-hop producer Nick Speed. So every single event or every single film has some sort of accompanying program with it. And so what we learned last year was people stayed for those. People really craved that interaction and that, you know, extra something special. So we've just added more of that this year.
You've also included some events for filmmakers or want-to-be filmmakers. Tell me about that event.
Yes, on Friday, all day Friday, we have the Freep Festival Academy. And essentially, it's an all-day workshop with a series of master classes, a panel discussion about the state of documentary filmmaking, as well as a free screening of some student films from a student from U of M, a couple from Wayne State, and a group of students from Michigan State. And so it's an opportunity for new filmmakers, student filmmakers to come and kind of learn about the craft from some of the best in the field. We have Harvey Ovshinsky. He's our artist in residence this year, and he's a local filmmaker just inducted into the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame. He's going to be doing two classes, and one particularly is a critique session where we've got some folks that have submitted works that Harvey is going to go through for the entire academy to kind of go through and pick through and help them learn from his expertise.
The Freep Film Festival starts tomorrow at the Fillmore Detroit, 7:30, with the Fire and Water double feature we talked about earlier. We've been talking to Artistic Director Kathy Kilishevsky. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. If you're interested in Michigan craft beer, and I mean really, who isn't? You might have heard about a dispute between Bell's Brewery in Kalamazoo and Innovation Brewing of Silva, North Carolina. In a nutshell, the larger Bell's Brewery filed a complaint against the fledgling Innovation Brewing because Bell's believes Innovation's name is too similar to a trademark Bell's owns, which is Bottling Innovation since 1985. Now, some people think Bell's is bullying the smaller brewery. Others say, come on, these trademark disputes are as common as dirt. With so many breweries and distilleries popping up all over, there are naturally going to be some naming conflicts. If trademarks aren't defended, though, by uses that are deemed confusingly similar, the trademark value can be lost. So while it's caused some bad public relations for Bell's to the point that they're using a Lansing PR firm to deal with the onslaught of news media interest, they almost are forced to do this as the course of business. Well, here's another trademark dispute. This one is from Traverse City. Brilliant Books got a cease and desist order from Bookspan. Bookspan is a subsidiary of Time Warner. Now, this is because Brilliant Books used the phrase Book of the Month Club to describe their book selection service that grew in popularity this past holiday season. Joining us now is Peter Macon. He's one of the owners of Brilliant Books. Why did you start using this Book of the Month Club phrase to describe the service?
Well, we did it, frankly, because it's what it describes what it does. So many folks are using Book of the Month Club. We had no idea that that anyone could possibly own that particular term. So we did it in all innocence, thinking it simply described us providing a monthly book service.
I was doing a little research, and the term Book of the Month Club actually has been trademarked since 1926. In fact, it's been used as an example by law schools to teach students about trademark phrases. It didn't occur to you at all that this might be registered.
No, and I can tell you, and I know that may seem a little naive, but if you Google Book of the Month Club, there are literally millions of entries. And there's a couple of other bookstores just up here near us in northwestern Michigan that have a Book of the Month Club. So because it was virtually ubiquitous, we figured there would really be no harm in using it. We thought it would be sort of as absurd as us, you know, we're Brilliant Books. We can't really stop people using the adjective brilliant when describing literature. And we thought it was probably in that sort of common usage, so it was fair game.
Yeah, so a bit of a surprise when you got that letter. What do you do now?
Well, what we do now, as you pointed out at the top of the piece, Bookspan is part of Time Warner. We don't have the resources at all to fight this, or even to begin to fight this. It'd be tens of thousands of dollars just to take it to court. But we've had a couple of legal folks tell us that because of the common usage, we would potentially win, and they would risk losing their rights. But I don't need to be the poster child for that. I don't have the tens of thousands of dollars that it would take to prove that particular point. It's way easier for me to simply say, okay, and change the name of our service. And that's what we're doing now. We're actually having a little competition on social media to try to see if folks can come up with a good name for us.
Right. I want to talk about that in a moment. But I want to ask you first about, I assume you spent some money on printing and signage using Book of the Month Club. So if you're not fighting it, what are you going to do with all that promotional material?
Well, we've got some awkwardly placed stickers on an awful lot of it, and we're having to be very careful because we don't want to launch with a whole new name until we're certain that that's going to be our good permanent name. We have a working title right now of Monthly Selection Service. That's just so we can call it something. But until we've got a permanent name, we can't reprint everything. But you're right. There are, you know, potentially a few thousand dollars worth of posters, inserts, cards, preference cards, all sorts of things that all need to be done all over again.
Now, you mentioned using social media to get your fans to come up with a new permanent name for the service. How's that going? Have you started it yet?
Oh, yes, and it's going really well. We have hundreds. In fact, my task this afternoon is to answer an awful lot of those folks and thank them for their entries. People are being very creative and extremely supportive, which is nice. It's very flattering. It's very moving. We didn't realize that folks felt so kindly about us, and it's a very nice thing indeed.
Do you have any favorites yet?
Well, the kind of thing we're actually looking for, a lot of people say, you know, Brilliant Book Club or some other, and we have a lot of very funny versions, which are probably a little too rude for your radio show. But we're really looking for a word that we can brand as being something that really gets across the very personalized nature of our service, because the irony here is that we would often say to people, we are not like the traditional Book of the Month Club, where everybody gets the same book, and if you don't refuse the book in time, we send it to you anyway. That would be our opening pitch. Like, no, Book of the Month Club, the thing you might have heard of, that's not us. We are this new thing that does something differently. We send you a little card. We ask you what genres you like, what authors you like, what you don't like. And based on that, we use expert booksellers to pick you. We handpick a book for all of these folks every month. So we're the polar opposite to the old traditional Book of the Month Club. And we need a name that will actually reflect that, so that very personalized, specific, handpicked service, so that actually comes across within the name.
Well, I hope you find an even more successful name, but I might suggest you might want to run it by a lawyer who specializes in trademark rights and then trademark the thing for yourself.
That's probably a good idea. We will most definitely be doing that, yes.
That's Peter Makin. He's one of the owners of Brilliant Books in Traverse City. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, sir. Cheers. It's a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Local government officials say they and their colleagues are pretty darn ethical, but boy, do they feel differently about state officials. Those are some of the findings in the latest Michigan Public Policy Survey by the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. Joining us is Tom Avaco. He manages the center, which we call Close Up for short. Let's start with how local leaders view ethics among their colleagues in cities, villages, county governments. What'd you find?
Yeah, mostly local leaders have pretty high opinion of their colleagues in local government across the state, and especially so in their own jurisdiction. So when we asked how ethical they think local leaders act in office, 70% said that they think local leaders across the state are either very or mostly ethical in office, although only 15% there said very ethical. For other leaders, 50.
That's kind of a concern right there.
Yeah, it is a bit. It is a bit of a concern. You know, if the goal is perfect ethics, which it probably should be, this is below that. When we asked about other local leaders in their own jurisdiction, the people they're most familiar with, opinions are the highest. 88% think that their colleagues in their own jurisdiction are very or mostly ethical. And their 53% say that they are very ethical. Another 35% say mostly ethical.
So when you ask these same local officials about state government officials, they had a very different view. Fewer than half of them think state legislators are very ethical or mostly ethical. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and in fact, they're probably the biggest concern is with state legislators. Local leaders, only 5% of local leaders think that state legislators in Michigan are very ethical. That's certainly a concern.
Now, they know these folks for the most part. I mean, local officials deal with their state legislator all the time. Do they know something we don't?
Well, that's the question. That's one of the reasons that we do these surveys, is that we think local leaders are a little bit more plugged in to state-level issues than typical citizens are. And, you know, of course, a lot of state legislators started their career in local government. So, yeah, local leaders across the state do know state legislators probably better than most of us do. And this is a concern that they have, you know, relatively low levels of belief in ethics at the state level.
So quickly, what are the rest of the numbers there?
So we also asked local leaders what they think about state executive branch leaders, and a little higher opinion compared to state legislators. 57% of local leaders think that executive branch leaders in Michigan state government are very or mostly ethical. So that is kind of, you know, middle of the path.
Now, there's one caveat to all this. You found there is some partisan politics behind those views of local officials about state officials.
That's right. Of course, Michigan's state government is controlled by the Republican Party, certainly the executive and legislative branches. And what we found is local leaders who are Republicans themselves tend to have a higher opinion of state government currently compared to independent and Democratic local leaders. So,
imagine that.
Yeah, it's it definitely filters through. I think there are some similarities there if we ask public opinion similar questions.
I was surprised to read in your survey that almost a third of the local officials say they have no formal code of ethics in their jurisdictions. First, of those who do, what's generally covered in a code of ethics?
Well, they're pretty diverse, I think. We looked at a range of these from local governments across the state, and they can cover a pretty wide range of issues, including things like conflict of interest, whether or not local leaders can accept gifts, whether or not they can take honoraria, free food and travel, and so on. So these codes of ethics can be pretty broad.
So why did nearly a third not have any code of ethics?
Well, that's a concern. We don't know exactly why they don't. We didn't have space on the survey to ask why or why not they had these. But and in particular, probably the biggest concern is in the biggest jurisdictions, 29% don't have them.
Wow.
And these are the places that are, you know, the most professional, and we would expect probably to see these.
If many of these local officials don't think the state officials are all that ethical, do they have ideas to fix that concern?
Yeah, we asked if they would support strengthening a range of policies on ethics, and there is overwhelming support to strengthen a number of different ones. Currently, state legislators in Michigan are prohibited from receiving honoraria, payment from an outside group. We asked local leaders if they think that should be extended to state executive branch leaders, and overwhelmingly, they think that should happen. We asked if there should be annual caps on gifts, free food, free travel, and so on for executive and legislators. Overwhelming support to do that.
And they also had an opinion about revolving door.
Yes, exactly.
Which is basically legislators leaving the office after their term limited or lose an election and becoming lobbyists.
That's exactly right. And 70% of local leaders think that there should be revolving door policies for both the executive and legislative branch for Michigan State government.
Tom Bivacco manages the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. You might have seen reports about a small Michigan town, fewer than 300 people, but with a force of 110 reserve police officers. I've been fascinated by this story and wondering how and why this came about in Oakley, Michigan. Well, reporter Ryan Felton at Metro Times did a deep dive into the story and answered those questions. He joins us now. First things first, Ryan, tell us about Oakley. What kind of town is it?
If you ever want to look for a textbook definition of a small town, I think it fits the bill perfectly. There's a very limited supply of businesses. There's two bars, a gas station, a couple churches, and like a hair salon, and that's about it.
Yeah, we're talking smaller than Mayberry here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the context they used was, you know, the greater downtown area is considered 7 square miles, so Oakley could fit in downtown Detroit 7 times neatly.
Now, in the past, this village has had one part-time police chief. That changed, though, when the village of Oakley hired Rob Resnick. He started this reserve police force as a way to raise money. So how does that work?
You know, basically, you have a guy who saw an opportunity to fund his department by allowing people to apply as a reserve officer if they paid for their uniform, badge, and firearm, and passed a number of tests, they would be able to work as a volunteer cop, and that usually rounded out to about $1,300 to cover the total cost, as it was explained to me. I think one of the issues that came up with this is that a lot of people got confused by that there's a donor list and then there's a list of reserves, and those two aren't the same. You could be a donor and not be a reserve, vice versa. And basically, this guy just made connections. He just, as he described it, and that really does seem to be the case, he picked up the phone, called somebody, and just asked, said, "I work for a small community that doesn't have a lot of money, and would you be willing to donate? And if so, would you be interested in being a reserve officer on my force?"
So you didn't have to be a resident of Oakley. These people could be from anywhere in Michigan or anywhere in the nation.
Yeah, so you have 98% of those who have applied to be a reserve officer come from Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb County. And it runs the gamut of, wealthy professions, everyone from doctors, attorneys to, you have a former Detroit Lions football player who now plays for the Miami Dolphins. I mean, it's a astounding, remarkable, cadre of officers that he's collected for his volunteer force.
And these people have police powers.
They do if they are in the presence of one of the certified officers. So that's one thing that, should be made clear, is that if they are in the presence of one of Oakley's certified officers, then they can take enforcement action. I think, the one catch here is that as a reserve officer, they get a special gun permit. Like if you or I had a CCW, if, we were to go somewhere, we couldn't take our firearm into certain locations. As a reservist, you can bring your firearm anywhere. And that, I think, is one of the catches of being a volunteer cop in this sort of capacity.
How does the village board feel about having this extra money and this relatively huge police force?
That was one of the most, I guess first off, reporters, I think, cover small towns, and they can get the sense as to what the, politics are of a small town and, what type of conversations take place in that sort of setting as opposed to, a big city like Detroit or Ann Arbor. The dynamic in the room during some of these meetings was just one of the most fascinating experiences to watch, because it was just like watching this ugly family feud just play out wide in the open, because you're not talking about people who are unfamiliar with each other. I mean, these
right,
are
they run
who,
into each other every day.
Right. And so it's not like your typical like political beef. It's not like a Monica Conyers, Ken Cockrell type beef that plays out in the open. You're talking about people who have known each other since they were children. And it's, you know, it was so, you know, odd to watch this happen. Because on one side of the room, you have people who are very happy that Rob Resnick has brought in such a significant amount of money. You know, we're talking about he's brought in as much donations as the town spends in a year for its general fund budget, just to give you some context. So there are some people who are just absolutely love the fact that he's been able to bring in this money and, you know, buy new computer equipment for the town, buy, you know, a new playscape for the community, that sort of thing. But on the opposite end, you have those who feel like this has just created this sort of pay-to-play atmosphere, and Resnick's able to just do as he pleases. And it's split, you know, right down the middle.
You reported the Village of Oakley is the subject of a dozen active lawsuits, and the majority of them have been filed by a guy who actually serves as a trustee on the village board.
Right.
That seems really complicated. What's up with that?
The guy, Dennis Bitterman, he owns a bar, one of the two bars, and after an incident that played out a few years ago involving the chief that is the subject of one of the lawsuits, that was a civil lawsuit that was filed, he's sort of raised hell consistently ever since. And it plays out in a very strange way because, you know, frequently the topic of discussion at these meetings over the last year has been these lawsuits. So you have a setting where a guy who is in a public meeting is suing the village and the board that he sits on, and they're having to talk about, you know, how the village is defending itself in the presence of the plaintiff. And it makes for just, you know, very strange, convoluted dialogue. But, you know, from an emotional standpoint, I think it's just important to stress that it's really caused, you know, a strain, not just financially, but just emotionally, too, on some of these residents.
So you have the benefit of new computers and a playscape in the park and all these extra officers if you need them for any reason at all. But the downside is you've got these lawsuits that are tapping the city's budget. You've got this division between people on the board and people in the village. It sounds like there's as much of a downside as there is an upside. But I want to look at the larger picture. Where's this going? Are other small towns who are struggling to get by because the state revenue sharing cuts, are they thinking about this kind of fundraising? I mean, will everybody who wants a badge and a gun soon become a reserve officer for some cash-strapped little town?
Well, that's something that, you know, I tried hitting on because I think that that's one of the biggest unanswered questions at this point because, you know, Rob proudly, you know, told me that this is something that isn't done elsewhere. It's a very novel approach, and you talk to other law enforcement officials, and, you know, they either, you know, find it totally out in left field, or they just, you know, consider it just completely, you know, revolutionary in terms of how to fund a department, because you're talking about a completely funded private department that's funded by just solely private donations. And the chief says he's gotten calls from other departments across the state about what he's done to make it happen. But, you know, I think that remains to be seen, I guess, especially, you know, when you consider the pushback in these lawsuits related to the volunteer force. I mean, I would be surprised if other communities would be interested in, you know, taking up that sort of backlash, you know, just for the sake of having some extra money coming in, because it financially speaking, it's been a detriment, you know, on the town's budget.
Ryan Felton is a reporter for Metro Times. We've been talking about his story, how one police chief and his 110 reserve officers have split the village of Oakley and its 286 residents. I like the subtitle, too, Ryan, Small Town Soap Opera. That seems fitting. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It was a shot heard across the state yesterday. Incoming state treasurer Nick Corey saying,
Treasury has a big role in helping to raise the living standards of all Michiganians.
Did you hear that? I mean, did you hear what he said? He called those who live in Michigan, Michiganians. Now, this led some to wonder, okay, let's be honest, really only the nerdy people, to wonder what this will mean to Governor Snyder and many of the other politicians and just regular folks across the state who say Michigander. Well, that had stateside producer Mike Blank thinking about some other nickname options.
A Minute with Mike.
Like most of you listening, I assume, I'm proud of being from Michigan. Trips up north, long summer sunsets, and the joys of boating across our many lakes, it's a common experience that each of us holds dear, and of which we can be proud. However, there's one certain aspect of being from Michigan which I find quite disconcerting, being called a Michigander. There's something about this particular word that leaves me with a feeling in the gut similar to binging on Coney Islands. In other words, gross. So, residents of Michigan, we need a new moniker that we can all be proud of. And this is where it gets difficult. Due to Michigan's syllable and sound structure, there's not a lot of linguistic clay to work with. There's the second standby, Michiganian, but that's the same amount of syllables as saying, I'm from Michigan. Don't believe me? Go ahead. Count it out. I did. Next on the list, there's Michiganers, but that rhymes with beginners and implies the state is full of novices. Michiganites or Mishites sounds like a bacteria-laden Old Testament rock formation. Michiganist could work, but doesn't roll off the tongue nicely and could subconsciously make folks feel bad for not flossing regularly. Mishy, well, that's kind of nice, sort of friendly, but it also sounds like a derogatory term used by Ohioans. For example, I was planning on going to Toledo, but so close to the state line that sick Mishy stench of corn, oil, soybeans, and fresh water really affects my asthma. So that leaves my personal favorite, Michiganeer. With our nautical connections and being comprised of two great peninsulas, it's perfect. And who wouldn't love to go by a hard-working, swashbuckling, salt-of-the-earth term like Michiganeer? M-I-C. See, I told you we need a new name. H-I-G. G, Michigander is a terrible name. A-N-E-E-R. Michiganeer.
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 With a name like that, we can hold our heads up high.
High, high, high.
So come along and join with me and end the Michigander tyranny. M-I-C-H-I-G-A-N-E-E-R.
Michiganeer.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstrith, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.